In the last episode, we considered the college process for alternative learners. We now take a look at the state of affairs for those who care for those young students, supporting parents of students with alternative learning and psych profiles, specifically for parents of students with ADHD and executive function deficits. I'll be joined by Melissa Billner today of Live Better Training. Melissa has three kids and a husband, all with ADHD. She has almost 20 years of experience living and parenting kids with ADHD and executive function challenges. This unique situation has empowered Melissa to develop a unique and practical set of skills and strategies for living with kids who have ADHD. Melissa is formally trained as a certified professional coach, an ADHD parent coach, and personal trainer. Melissa also has training in collaborative problem solving from Dr. Stuart Ablon at Think Kids. She regularly keeps up with the latest research on parenting, ADHD, and executive functioning skills. Melissa's personal experiences combined with her formal training make her uniquely qualified to provide an authentically supportive and empathetic coaching experience. She has the ability to allow parents to feel heard and understood, and combine this feeling with offering practical strategies that parents can easily implement into their own parenting style. Melissa, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. So could you explain your background and specifically what got you in coaching?
So originally I was in marketing. When I got married, we decided I would stay home with the kids. And I've always been that person who is trying to improve myself, always. And I did a lot of volunteer work and my kids were very challenging from the beginning. I knew something was up. And so through my own journey of figuring out how to manage my kids, what's going on with them, they seem different, especially starting with my oldest. What do I do with this? And I ended up looking for a coach, an executive function coach for my oldest when she was 14. And when I had my consultation with that coach, through discussions with her, she said to me, she goes, "Your kid doesn't need a coach, you do." And I hired her. The rest is history. I said, "Boy, this makes so much sense. My kid doesn't even know what a coach is. She doesn't know anything about getting help in this manner." And so I started to work with this woman and she was my mentor for a while and I did her training program and I became a coach.
And what did this coach do for you exactly?
So she did a couple things. One is she became kind of a sounding board and she helped me see things from a different perspective. And she helped me get a real understanding that like a 14-year-old still has a developing brain and what that really means. And then she helped me with strategies to parent a 14-year-old brain and have the ability to give my child the support she needed to get her homework done and make plans with friends and stuff like that.
Interesting. So we sort of talked about it a little bit before we got on here, but you have three kids of your own and a husband with ADHD, as your site says. How is that personal experience as a parent and as a wife equipped you to assist other parents?
So it's impacted me is that, as I mentioned, I've done a ton of research in education and learning, I've been coached myself, then becoming a coach. And so I have a certain level of expertise in this area, an incredible amount of resources to help people. And it's my way of paying it forward. So I want to normalize having challenging kids also. The parenting is hard and no one ever told us it was going to be that way. And then if your kids don't fit in the box, then all of a sudden, not only is your kid different, but you're different. And people are passing judgment on you. And then how do you live with that? And how do you fit into the society or live in society? You might not fit, right? You might never fit into that box, but we still have to live here.
Right. And find an alternative path.
Right. And also being okay with that alternative path, that an alternative path isn't bad. And it's that message of being different isn't bad.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that you're focused on the parent too. In a lot of ways, that's kind of the foundation for the child to begin with. So if the parent's kind of in good shape and is a rock, that's kind of maybe even more important.
I agree. So my perspective has become, and this is what I started to learn with that first post. I kind of always felt this way, but it became solidified that we are our children's guide. We are their teachers. We are the ones who have a say over what they get to do and what they don't get to do. We give them morals and ethics and foundation, to use your word, and grounding. They might get influenced by teachers, whether it's the piano teacher or the history teacher or the camp counselor. They get exposure to them. They get influenced by them. But all of that is impacted by the guidance and morals and ethics that we as parents give them.
Yeah, and I think any parent can testify that the parent's mental health has a very direct impact on the child is.
Yes, and not only that, like mental health is like a big picture thing, but how the parent feels about themselves and their ability to guide their child.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're not taught that. Nobody teaches us that. And it's a big secret. Everyone's in denial. Everyone's like, my kids are perfect. Yay, we made the bed. What's interesting is that social media is presented like this idea of we have to present ourselves. Whereas in the past, when we didn't have social media, everything was a secret because you just didn't talk about it.
Right. So you have a lot of certifications that I noticed on your website related to coaching, some of which I hadn't even heard of. I'm wondering which of these degrees is sort of most important to highlight in your mind?
So I just want to say that I think the combination of all of them really benefits me because I have elements from each certification that have infiltrated my life, how I do things and stuff. But if I have to pick one, I think it's the life coaching certification, which is the CPC, Certified Professional Coach. And that one was really important because, like, for instance, when I became a personal trainer, I already knew how to exercise. But I learned other things about exercise when I did that certification that I can use in my coaching. But the Certified Professional Coach certification gave me a lot of information and education about how we communicate. And that infiltrated not only how I talk to clients, but also now it changed the way I talk to my kids, the way I talk to other people. And it really is interesting. And when you asked me that question, I really thought about that. It really impacted how I speak now.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of different certifications out there to become a coach, aren't there? But I mean, I think finding a good one is key.
Right. And so what I learned is that there's this organization called the International Coaching Federation, and they call themselves the gold standard in coaching. And coaching is not a regulated industry. Anybody can call themselves a coach. But what's great right. about the ICF is that they are actually working to regulate the industry. So they qualify a lot of these programs. And personally, my experience has been that any program I've done that's been qualified by them has been incredibly valuable. So that's kind of what I follow. And they do things like, for instance, when I have a client, they have to sign a contract that is a confidentiality agreement, basically. And the ICF recommends that we follow ethics that are quite similar to HIPAA in terms of confidentiality and privacy and stuff like that. So when I talk about clients, I never reveal who they are. I might talk about an experience I had with a client, but people don't know who they are. It's up to that client if they want to tell someone they got with me.
What is the greatest challenge you find in balancing the responsibilities of your coaching practice with those of your family and being a parent to your tribe, basically?
Yeah. So I think having a business and raising a family is always a challenge. I'm sure you agree. You have a business. But I find balance by knowing and living by my priorities. And for me, my priorities is family first. So my kids always come first. And that is actually the first thing I ask parents when I meet them is, what are your parenting priorities? A lot of people don't think about that. And it informs everything that we do, though. It goes back to what we were saying about giving our kids morals and ethics and guidelines and stuff. If we don't know these things, then it's hard for us. Or if they're not like more on the surface, right? We know them. They're just deep inside. And then the other thing that I wanted to add is that what's nice about this kind of business that I'm doing is that I learn a lot when I coach people, and hopefully they learn from me. So I'm able to use a lot of that information in my parenting. So it helps with the balance.
Here are a few things that stuck out to me after the first segment of my conversation with Melissa. Being a parent really is about being the leader for that child in terms of their intellectual and psychological well-being. As such, I think it's critical for you to sort of take care of your own house, put your own house in order. That is, in a lot of ways, the harder task. And I think it's a little bit easier to turn outwards and think about what our children can do better. But the harder task is perhaps to set ourselves straight, because for a very important reason, that, above everything else, is really what directly impacts their well-being. It directly impacts how they're doing in school, how they're feeling psychologically, their ambitions, the future. Really, I don't think there's anything more important than leading by example as a parent. And I know that to be true because it sounds hard. It sounds difficult. There isn't any shortcuts, really, in parenting that I've found. If you do find some, let me know. But it's difficult work, and a lot of it has to do with self-reflection in perhaps ways that we haven't had to do before. So that's exactly why, you know, this type of service exists and why it's so important. Another thing that came up in that first segment was the importance of the different certification programs that you have for coaches. There are so many soft skills involved with coaching in terms of emotional intelligence, psychological well-being, that it's very difficult to find good coaches, and I think there's a lot of bad coaches out there, or amateur, I guess, is the best way to put it. It can be hit or miss. So I think it's important that the International Coaching Federation, which she had certification in, is attempting to standardize that and turn that program into something that is reliable, that certification actually means something, because there's innumerable degree programs out there for coaching, and many of them are not good. Some are, and Lord knows if I could tell the difference. So I think it's a great movement there to establish a regular certification program so that it makes the process of finding a coach that much easier. Another point that was brought up was the connection of business to one's personal life, particularly when talking about home office, when you're working from home. I think that's critical. It's so hard to compartmentalize business from family life and to kind of separate them away, especially when they're existing in the same space or side by side. I think that's sort of inevitable. I mean, you can't really completely turn your mind and your focus to something entirely different if you're talking about having a conversation with your teenager and then going back to what you're doing professionally and not have some crossover and not have those two things sort of inform each other. I think that the most successful businesses probably combine those things, that there is some crossover between the two worlds. What you do personally affects what you do in life. What you do in life affects what you're doing personally. And finding ways to bridge those two worlds, I think, can be very important for being prolific in both of them. So what does coaching for a parent of a child with ADHD and NDF deficits look like? What's the kind of usual course you take or a process that you go through? What's that like?
Well, so first I want to acknowledge that no matter what, your parenting is hard. And it doesn't matter if your kid has a diagnosed disability or not, parenting is hard. We are responsible for these little people, children, becoming happy, resilient adults. That's a lot on our shoulders. So it is really hard. And it's extra hard when we have a kid that's different from the other kids and different from us. I know I expected my kids to be just like me. And now I see that some of them have elements of things that are like me, but for the most part, they're not like me and they're not like my husband. They are their own individuals. And that is, I think, a huge like light bulb moment to have. And then how do you manage that? And how do you have a relationship with that? So when I work with people, the first thing that I do is provide empathy and compassion and understanding. And I often give them some quick education because often people, they only know the myths of ADHD. Sometimes I had someone come to me once, they're like, well, my kid got a diagnosis of executive function deficit. And I was like, okay, that's not a diagnosis. So let's talk about what that really means. And actually, I asked that person, I suggested that they can call it whatever they want, but if they want to get other treatment for their kid, they had to go back to their practitioner and their provider and get a real diagnosis. Because if you want to do different treatments, someone's going to look at executive function deficit and be like, okay, that's great. Sorry your kid has that. So we talk about that kind of stuff. And then usually the coaching goes like this. I have like four key elements that we work on, and they can be one session, multi-session, whatever. And we work on parenting priorities, what it means to observe your child and child observation, connection through communication, and clarity through collaboration. And those are big picture umbrella points. And so we can dive into those however people want. Often we do it based on like, I can't get my kids to do homework, something like that. And it turns into like these aha moments of like, wait. Or like I have one client come to me and say, you know, I think my kid does have ADHD, but they're fine at home and he's in middle school and he's starting to fall behind. So I just want to kind of figure that out. And then through the discussion, I find out it was a single parent. She can't get him to do the laundry. His room is always a mess. He never comes to dinner when she asks, and he never gets his homework done. All of that stuff is at home. Now, it didn't bother her so much, but it came out, you know, like, so people, it's not siloed. Like, it impacts your entire life. So we talk about that. And also, the other message I think that I want to talk about when we talk about parent coaching is that I think every parent is a good parent. It's not about whether or not you're a good parent. It's about how to make your family life better. Because if what you're doing isn't working and you're still yelling and screaming and feel like you're banging your head against the wall and your kid's room is still a mess and the homework still isn't getting done, then maybe it's time to do something different. That's all kind of I'm saying.
You covered a lot of ground there. I wanted to get back to what you're talking about in terms of the diagnoses. I'm curious if you take a look at this educational research or the IPs or that sort of thing. Are you helping sort through those specifics and kind of how to interpret what is a lot of very technical data in a lot of cases?
So I can do that, and I have done that for people. I think it's important to note that evaluations are a moment in time. They're often two or three-hour sessions, one-on-one, and the kid is one-on-one with a stranger, right? It's often a doctor they haven't met before, a psychiatrist or someone like that. And they're asked to do these tasks that they've never seen before. So it's these moments in time. And I think where I can best help a parent is help them understand that these are moments in time. And we can talk about what each of these things mean. And help them determine what they want to pursue. Because often these evaluations, I've seen 50 pages. And then it's like two of those pages are a list of recommendations of what you need to get done. So you can't do all those things. So I can help parents prioritize that. I can help them with understanding what each of those recommendations mean. I can help them with what questions to ask, either the evaluator or another provider, stuff like that. So that's how I deal with the evaluations.
I can tell you as an English teacher, you know, sometimes you'd be handed the 50-page document and, you know, you have four of the classes of students, you know, and other IEPs, and you're expected to sort of apply that. My student load was too much and my technical training was not... I mean, in educational testing. So I think it's important for the parents to have an understanding of what's on that paper if they want to have some sort of agency in what they actually want for their child in the classroom, because that's not going to happen automatically, I don't think. It doesn't matter what the school says. The school's trying to appease you.
Yes, agreed. So I would never hand a neuropsych to a teacher, and I would never coach someone to do that. But I do coach people on how to work with the school, how to work with teachers. You know, I can give them providers about like what happens at a PPT meeting, how to manage the IEP to your point. And a lot of what I talk about with people is understanding that they need to have relationships with the teachers and that it's a team approach.
Definitely.
When you have a relationship with a teacher and you have a conversation, say at the end of the school day, when school's not in session anymore, the teacher is going to tell you things. They might have a list of two or three things they need to tell you, but you're having a conversation. So then you're going to get two or three more things and you're going to learn more about what's happening in the classroom. And that's only going to happen if it's a give and take. So now as the parent, you're telling the teacher, you know, when Johnny comes home, he has a meltdown. I can't get him to do his work. And here's what I think is happening with the homework. You're giving him a math sheet with 20 questions on it. What can we do? I think 20 is too much. Can we take baby steps with this? How can we make this work? And so that's what I try to help parents do, because parents think for some reason, so this goes back to what I was saying before about us being the guide for our kids, is you're not just handing your kids over to these other people and saying, raise my kid. Like, just because I don't know how to teach math, because I don't know how to teach
math.
That's
not going to go very well.
I think some people do that, though. And I think some parents do kind of pass it off and expect the system to flawlessly sort all of these issues.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that don't do that. What I'm saying is you're in charge of your kid, you know, and you need to understand what's important to you and to your kid. And you're part of their life. It's not like they're just home and they're just at school. And what's interesting is that often people with executive function deficits and ADHD, they have this like siloing in their life. And so if we continue to encourage that, it's going to be hard for them to then have relationships later in life, because they need to understand that, you know, home talks to school and school talks to home in order to be successful. I think what happens for some parents is that they get defensive. They think that the teacher is just punishing their kid. And the truth is mm-hmm. I think what I've seen is that sometimes it's happening because that's just the way the teacher does things and they don't care. But sometimes it's happening because the teacher doesn't understand because they don't know.
Yeah.
And they don't have the time and the education to sit there and go, what's going on for this kid? They're not trained for that. And that's okay. So I help parents understand that that's why it's their job to say, you know, hey, teacher, here's what's happening for my kid. What can we do? To each parent, their child is the most important one. So I can help parents manage that too, where the classroom, as a teacher, you're teaching 15 kids and maybe in private school, 25, maybe in public, whatever it is. And so the parent has to understand where they may need to provide additional support if they can, because a teacher physically and mentally just can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. What about those workshops? What are those?
Okay. I think that the school relationship is incredibly important because it's such a big part of our children's lives. And my workshops are a way for parents to get introduced to me and what I do. It's also a way for people to let parents know that they're not alone, because it's a group situation. I do them live and online, depending on where I'm giving them. And each workshop definitely gives some information and education about executive function deficits and ADHD. And you come out with strategies and ways to start to look at your kids differently, communicate with them differently, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed you had something called the 8 C's of parenting on there.
Yeah, that's my little parenting cheat sheet. So I came up with like 8 things that a parent needs to remember when trying to develop a better relationship with their kids. So it's stay calm, make connection, communicate, collaborate, be consistent. It's okay to have clarity. It's okay to have consequences and choices. So we all have choices. Those 8 things that can help people really change how they parent if they want to.
I got you. Well, that's a helpful acronym, I'd say. Are there any success stories you could share with us from your practice?
I'm so glad you asked. So I had a parent, a father, come to me, and his initial question was, help me get my wife diagnosed with ADHD so that my family life will be better. You're like, how'd you succeed with that guy? So his story is that he would come home from work, and he works for himself, and the house would be a mess. The kids were running amok. Homework wasn't getting done, and the kids were using screens beyond the agreed upon time, and none of the rules were being followed. The wife, who's a stay-at-home mom, or if she works, she works like at home, and it's like she's really available in the after-school hours. You know what I mean? There were 4 kids, by the way, so really was. I know, it's all very relatable. But this guy was so angry. Yes. He wanted things a certain way, and he would come home and just yell the whole night. He'd be yelling at the kids, yelling at the wife, fighting with the wife because she would fight back. So what I do is I meet with people on a free consultation, which is a half hour. And that's when we decide what the best approach is. A 4-session package. I swear to you, this happened in 4 sessions where he went through the process of him understanding his situation, understanding that he only has control over himself. He can't control his wife or the kids for that matter. And at the end of the 4 session, he was able to stop yelling at the 13-year-old, which was the oldest and really the one we talked about the most. He started talking with her and also was able to provide her with the necessary support to guide her through passing a class she was failing. So during our time period, he found out it was like 4 months into school and the teacher lets him know that she's failing the class. So this goes back to our discussion earlier. Yes. Had either him or the mom been in contact with the teacher in the first place, they would have known about it beforehand. Because of course, the daughter's like, I got it, which is a whole nother discussion about why she says that she doesn't know how to ask for help and stuff. But he was well on his way to having those conversations with her. And then also because of this, he came home and he needed to decompress also. And he was just basically like exploding all his workday frustration onto the family. Yeah. So he was able to contain that by stepping back and taking a look at his family, who they were, doing a lot of introspection work, getting understanding that he can't control them. And of course, deciding what his priorities were. Once you realize all that yelling and fighting is ruining your relationships, it helps you rethink what you do. Because you don't think about it that way. As a parent, I think that as parents, we think, well, I'm just so frustrated and they have to do it. I want to get them to do it. We don't think about the long-term impact of that, but help parents see that.
Here are a few things that stuck out to me about the second portion of my conversation with Melissa. The process of reading IEPs and how to sort of contextualize those. I found those experiences, particularly when a student changes so much over time as they do, especially in those years that we're talking about, high school, middle school, but also understanding that they're in this educational center and that they're under the watchful eye of somebody they haven't worked with before, that can really kind of inform, you know, what's happening in that IEP. And that's something I think you need to interpret, get some sort of working interpretation for, so that you can apply the sort of principles and the value that's in that IEP to help your child. Another thing that stuck out was about relationships with teachers and how critical those relationships can be and all of the politics that are involved in managing those relationships. You know, as a former teacher, I can tell you that there's certainly a lot of positioning of the teachers trying to please the administration trying to please their shareholders, and that sort of political game often guiding things. I thought her advice was great about developing a personal relationship with the teachers. And I think that's the way to trump that or to overcome or to get outside of that sort of political positioning. You have a personal relationship with that teacher. You are going to hear the little nuances in that relationship, the way that it evolves. And you're going to be able to get insights that you're not going to if you go through bureaucratic or administrative channels. That personal relationship at the same time is very key and critical, I think, in the educational experience that your child is going to get. Now, this isn't easy. Human relationships are hard, as I often say, but just making the effort to do that in a friendly and amicable and open way, I think will open a lot of doors for relationships of that sort and subsequent value to your student's education. Another thing that stuck out was her case study with the husband that she was working with that got basically, I would say, got his own house in order. He stopped yelling. He brought a level of sanity to his parenting that hadn't been there previously. And immediately everything resolved. I don't think there's any mystery to that. I think putting your own mental health, your own well-being in order would immediately impact the sort of sanity around your house. If a child's being yelled at, and I'm not saying I'm immune from this either, I lose my temper as well, I should say. I hate when I do it, but it does happen. But that yelling immediately puts them into fight or flight mode and it registers as a trauma. And that's immediately a moment when they can't learn, because we don't learn in moments of trauma. And it also just compromises the relationship between the parent and the child and reduces the amount of trust that's there between those two and destabilizes the whole relationship. So I think it's important to keep one's own sort of temper in check in parenting. I'm not saying it's easy. It's very difficult because these are stressful moments. They're happening off and on. You haven't slept well, you're sick, or you're under stress at work, or, you know, there's all sorts of outside contextual factors that impact that relationship. But I think prioritizing it in the times that I have personally makes a big impact on the relationship with the child, and you just feel a heck of a lot better about yourself and your life if you're doing a great job parenting. So how has the landscape of parent coaching evolved in the post-pandemic era? When did you start?
I actually kind of started during the pandemic.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. But I liked your question and I thought a lot about it. So I think what I want to do is qualify that my answers are anecdotal and they're based on my personal and professional experience. And so I think parent coaching has become more necessary since we know during the pandemic, parents saw what was really happening for their kids, who was able to sit and focus, who wasn't. We learned that this kind of communication is good for some things and not others, stuff like that. And so they started to realize something needs to change, whether or not their kid has ADHD. Yeah. And then another problem I saw during the pandemic, again, personally and professionally, is increased screen use, whether it's social media or otherwise. And I think that has made the kids so comfortable with texting and video calls that they're uncomfortable in having relationships in person and talking to people in person. And they don't always know what to say to each other. And the kids, they get together and they're looking at their phones. They're not talking to each other, even though they're hanging out together. What I think parent coaching can help people with is that it can help parents see that issue, for instance, help the parents themselves get out of the rut, because we're in it too. We're totally in it, always checking our phones, et cetera. And then coach them, again, back to this communication thing, how to talk to your kids, how to teach them about screen use, for instance, to use that one thing as an example. And help them now partner with their kids, get their kids talking to other kids, maybe get them outside, whatever it is. And I think this is an even bigger challenge for kids who do have ADHD, because some of them do have a hard time reading facial expressions. They do have a hard time looking people in the eye. And it's easy when you're like this. And while it might look like I'm looking you in the eye, I'm not. I'm looking at a camera. And that's different.
No, right here.
And so helping parents understand that difference and understand that your kid has a hard time looking someone in the eye or reading a facial expression, it's a little mind-blowing for people. They don't understand it.
If you had one piece of parting advice for parents of these students, what would that parting advice be?
So it's kind of two pieces. I would say to parents to get support so that you can give your kids the guidance that they need and want, and that we don't have to do it alone. That's my second thing. We are in it together.
Oh, yeah.
Kids don't have the ability to tell parents what they want or need because they don't always know because their brains are developing. They can't see the future. My other thing is to destigmatize ADHD. And so even at a PTA meeting, you're not necessarily out there going, well, my kid can't get the math homework done because he can't sit still for 2 minutes. Like, you're not saying that, you know, or my kid is the only one not being invited to birthday parties. I see that all over Facebook. And how do we as parents deal with that, right? Because now our kid is stigmatized and they might not even know they have ADHD.
Here are some conclusions I had following my conversation with Melissa. One thing that came up was technology and the impact that can have on our relationships with our kids. And I think that's very important and perhaps something that doesn't get enough shine. There's all this concern about screens and social media and the impact it can have on youth. All the while, we're kind of trying to sweep under the carpet our own use of screens and reliance on those. And I don't know if we can do that. But one thing that a child is really, really cognizant of is hypocrisy. I remember very specifically being a teenager and somebody is telling me to do something and then doing the opposite or committing that offense themselves. It was just really triggering for me. and immediately put me in a place where I didn't want to listen to them. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important to lead by example, to set that model, to be able to be that type of authority. Now, if you're going to do that with screens, oh boy, that means managing your own screen time and managing the way that you're using screens around kids. And I'm cringing inside as I'm saying this because I'm constantly using technology. I'm on my phone almost all the time. You know, for business, it's very important, you know, some emails, text messages, etc. Although I will grant also that there are, you know, guilty pleasures for me on screens as well, you know, that I sometimes use probably too much around them. But that might actually dictate the degree to which you can be an authority on responsible use of screens. So I think it's very important to monitor your own screen time around the kids, whether that's setting aside on a particular day, like a Sunday, and not having any technology around the kids, setting boundaries around it, not why, whether it's setting aside special time with those kids where you're interacting directly with them and don't have any screens. You know, whatever that is, I think it's important to make those efforts in order to have the ground to stand on to be able to have those difficult conversations about technology with them. Another thing that stood out, I think that's very important in our conversation, was the importance of getting support in raising your kids. You know, there's been a number of articles, research that have come out recently about the degradation of community, people not going to churches anymore, community centers, just plain interacting socially. There are fewer opportunities and meeting places for that to happen. Malls, you know, take your pick, town centers. The space for that is quickly degrading. And the ones most affected by it are probably youth. Because the old cliche is that it takes a village. Well, it does take a village. You can't raise these kids on their own, I can tell you. Having to be myself, it's a disaster. You just don't have enough knowledge, insight, energy, enthusiasm, whatever that resource, that parenting resource is, that's really critical in bringing them up. You just don't have enough. You know, they need so many different perspectives and they benefit from a diversity of attitudes, of voices, of experiences, and their development depends on it. So having the support of other people in raising them, I think, cannot be overstated. And going it alone is detrimental on a number of levels. One that surprises me, I had not anticipated it, is just a simple lack of perspective about what should be normal. You know, there's catastrophizing, I think, that happens if you're in isolation and you see a particular behavior or, you know, from yourself or from the child or from that relationship that feels horribly, horribly wrong. But then the moment you get another set of eyes on that and discuss it with another parent, you suddenly realize that it's fairly normal or perhaps even trivial compared to what other things are happening out there with parents and the same struggles that they're having. So that's probably the most important thing. And that's really what she harped on throughout our discussion, was the benefit of having another parent's advice, sagacity, and also just reflecting on their experience as well.